Yankee's Monument, a dream tale of goblinhood. By James Beatty, read by Goblinhood. This tape that commences at the top of page 16, the top of page 16, and it backtracks by about the tune of one small paragraph, just for the sake of clarity. So if you're reading this in order to find out stuff about Libby Gregory, then you wasted your nickel, because I really don't know much more about her than I've already told you. But that doesn't mean there isn't more to say. I hope you'll bear with me while I try to say it. Before I can go on, however, I have to try to explain something about myself, something that I really don't know how to explain, but I guess it involves the so-called emotional problems, which I promised not to drag into this unless I had to. Well, in this particular instance, I guess that I have to. I just, like I said, don't know exactly how to. So I guess I'll fall back on a favorite metaphor of mine involving a cash register. Only this cerebral mechanism describes the flat and lifeless way in which my emotions register in my mind. What I'm about to describe isn't entirely uniform. Occasionally something will get through to me with enough impact to register as pain, and that I can feel with something akin to hysterical sensitivity. For that matter, we can leave out of consideration here most negative emotions, all the way up to, but not including, hatred, which I'm unable, or not allowed, to indulge myself in. I can't explain this last at all, other than to say that it's probably some kind of ethical phenomenon connected with my big harmlessness taboo/fetish belief system. But all lesser negative emotions, excepting only grief, seem to come through loud and clear. It's mostly the positive emotions that are muted way down. And grief hardly seems to register in me at all, except under special circumstances which seldom appear to obtain. As for that cash register image that I evoked, I don't know what any of you feel like when you're happy or delighted or joyous or anything like that, but for myself, when something happens that I know should make me happy, it feels as dull, for the most part, as if somebody were hitting an old-fashioned cash drawer keyboard in my mind, making a little sign pop up in the window on top, a sign which laconically reads, "Happiness." And that's about all that I'm usually able to feel. It doesn't even ring very loud under most circumstances. So I tell myself that I'm happy, because I know that I should be, but it barely even changes whatever dreary mood I happen to be in at the time, dreary moods being a kind of specialty of mine. And mostly, in any case, as far as positive emotions go, all that ever gets rung up is a no sale sign, life being what it seems to be, from my dreary viewpoint anyway. My strongest positive emotions are usually a form of fretful relief when my work is going well, but even that mild sensation quickly gives way to whatever problem-solving anxieties surround the next bit of work on my agenda. oddly, I can't even be certain that any of this is abnormal, because I've nothing to compare it with, except for whatever you people might tell me. And talk is cheap, as I ought to know, right? Meanwhile, if, for instance, my ethical taboo regarding hatred sounds like bullshit, maybe it is. So let's suspend it for the moment. Which of you should I start with? And just how hateful do you want me to get? And exactly how much of that emotional poison can my system accommodate before the stuff simply transforms into total bloodthirsty xenophobia aimed at my most hated and feared natural enemies, the scariest predators around, namely the entire human race? No, it's better to try to damp it down philosophically as I go along. And believe me, my aversions to humanity can get pretty savage, even without resorting to hatred. In any case, what I'm trying to talk about here is grief, or my odd way of handling that, or rather not handling that. There's a line I want to quote from the classic song Fire and Rain by James Taylor. Perhaps surprisingly, it isn't a bit about sweet dreams and flying machines and pieces on the ground, if that's how that line goes. No, I want to quote the line at the end of the song's chorus that says something like, "But I always thought I'd see you again." I'm not quoting this in order to sound poetic or anything. I'm using it to illustrate part of what my mind seems to be doing when my friends fall out of the sky or whatever. Somehow, a part of my mind, and a seemingly dominant part at that, is apparently unable to register human death as a real or perhaps exactly permanent phenomenon, or at least as a truly thorough situation. And in certain limited ways, I think that my mind gets to be sort of right about that, for whatever it's worth, even without dragging religion into things. Take my late friend Libby, for example. What was she, really, in the physical world? Apart from her self-awareness, which physics itself is still pondering, I believe, Libby, like everything else here, was basically a complex dance of subatomic particles. And sadly, due to circumstances inhospitable to life, one day the particles stopped dancing for her. And physically, that was that. But what was Libby to me when she wasn't around? A collection of hazy memories. Basically an imponderable thought pattern in my keeping. In short, a part of my own self-awareness. And in that form, she still exists, manifesting herself here, for instance. To you, the reader, if you didn't know Libby in life, her particles never danced. But you can still know her, as she still exists for me, though not, alas, as vividly, through reading this. And as for the dream version of Libby, that's never been anything but a thought pattern in my mind. But it's as real now as it would have been during her lifetime, and realer to me during the dream than my memories of her while I'm awake. So what is life? Don't ask goblinhood. He was never alive, as we usually think of it, to begin with. But he really exists as a kind of thought pattern to this day. And as for the dream version of goblinhood, don't ask. Libby never knew goblinhood to where she could have coffee with him, like she once did with Buckethead. But she was probably aware, to some extent, of the mural version of goblinhood, assuming that she ever saw his mural during its brief public tenure. I don't think Libby ever saw the current version of G.H. at all, though his present-day mask had been created in its first draft out of three so far while she was still among the living. But I don't think that Libby happened to be around during the first and only time goblinhood ever publicly wore that mask previous to her demise. Still, that goblinhood adventure did take place during Libby's lifetime, and so I'm going to tell some of the story of it, partly because it helps to shed light on goblinhood's actual experiences with the police, a subject that, for some reason, loomed large in the Libby's Monument dream. And perhaps that's only fitting, since the cops loomed so large during my earliest quasi-memory of Libby. J.B. indeed. On the first Saturday of every month, something called a gallery hop occurs in the Short North area of Columbus, Ohio, approximately between downtown and Fifth Avenue. This info for the benefit of outlanders in Timbuktu, New York, and other unknowledgeable hinterlands. All the galleries and most of the shops along High Street are open then, and crowds come to mill about and soak up some culture. It's been called a good place for a cheap date. It's also a good place for street theater if you don't step too hard on anyone's toes. It's been going on for over a decade. Oddly, I believe this all started right after goblinhood started getting mixed up with his Martian buddies. But that's probably just a strange coincidence. Gallery hops usually last until late at night. By the time of the gallery hop in March of 1990, I'd shown some of my paintings at these events, including one at the Acme Art Company, then located near Buttles Avenue on High Street, where I'd also taken to hanging around off and on. I was moving into one of my more outwardly directed periods and wanted to get more involved in the local art scene. Part of this was due to the sense of siege brought on by the big congressional brouhaha surrounding Senator Jesse Helms, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Helms Jihad against what he regarded as obscene, blasphemous, and other controversial art. Parts of my work had been falling into those categories for almost two decades, and I didn't want to leave the struggle to amateurs and greenhorns. Besides, I've always been a sucker for lost causes. Anyway, by March of 1990, I created a new mask for goblinhood with a big, colorful spider on the front, symbolizing, among other things, harmless but unpalatable art, useful for dealing with unpalatable truths, and a Martian harmlessness sigil, a sort of magical icon, emblazoned on the mask's forehead. Beyond its symbolic aspects, the spider, on a black field, was meant to make Goblin Hood look weird, as though he had a big spider for a face. So far I'm on the third edition of this handmade mask, but they've all looked about the same. Only the cloth material has changed, in the direction of being easier to wear and more form-fitting. By the time in question, Buckethead was long since kaput, and Goblin Hood couldn't have been happier about it. Now nothing stood in his way. Nothing, that is, except for the possible recalcitrance of the entire rest of the world, which might not take too kindly to having some masked weirdo running around loose. But Goblin Hood was ready to bust out of his 8-year-long self-imposed exile, and who can blame him? Yeah, I know, all of you can, but I meant, who can blame him without being an asshole or a dickhead? I mean, cripes, it's all just meant in harmless fun, you know? By this time, the quantum elevator man had taken to calling himself the Warlock of Mars, and not without some justification. His researché extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional, quasi-Lovecraftian antics behind the scenes had even progressed to the point where he was supposed to be trying to prevent nuclear war on behalf of us all. And he felt he could do a better job of that if he broke in the new mask. That harmless Martian sigil, for instance, would be more effective if he was actually wearing it around and, in that way, further energizing it. Besides, Goblin Hood wasn't created to exist in a vacuum. As an item of performance art, he was designed to be seen by an audience, preferably a live audience, however casually or cryptically. So taking the mask out to play was literally a matter of life and death for the old gobster, and was the first and most important step in his campaign to establish himself as a sort of dubious celebrity and an artificial life form, let alone as whatever kind of messianiac / manke he's actually shaking out as in this or any other dimension. And who can blame him for not having a chance, and who can blame him for not having a choice in this matter? Nobody, of course, except for a bunch of assholes and dickheads and spoil sports. Naturally, he knew that most people would react to him with misguided fear and loathing, for a while anyway, and forever in some cases, but go please the world. What about the cops, though? Goblin Hood didn't know which side of the law his masked visage in and of itself actually came down on, and still doesn't know. He hasn't looked into it. G.H. figures that ignorance of the law, however culpable, is probably better than having to just go fuck yourself on account of some short-sighted, small-minded, petty ordinance or another. He's right, too. In this world, if you look hard enough, you'll find that there's some red tape rule or another, obscure perhaps, but arbitrarily enforceable, against just about everything. Since some discussion of this aspect of things is probably inevitable, I'm moved to make the following remarks based on long and thoughtful reflection concerning this very subject. First, G.H. doesn't wear the mask as a disguise. It's way too distinctive for that, and In any case, I, as the artist involved, actually want credit for my work. So sooner or later, Goblin Hood's doings are all destined to be laid at my doorstep. Hence, Goblin Hood's mask isn't meant to facilitate in the commission of a crime. If I wanted to commit a crime, I'd wear some nondescript or generic mask so that it wouldn't get blamed on Goblin Hood. Perhaps a Donald Duck mask. Then it could get blamed on Walt Disney. Meanwhile, if you happen to see a bank robber, for instance, wearing a Goblin Hood mask, it's just some criminal trying to get me into trouble. And anyway, chances are that the Marcin sigil on that mask won't turn out to be really harmless after all. Second, Goblin Hood is neither a political statement nor a fashion statement, or at least his mask isn't meant to be taken as such. Politically, Goblin Hood is most closely associated with freedom of expression, and perhaps the mask can be regarded as an aspect of that, though it's a sticky question in the light of arguments which will soon follow in this discussion. At any rate, the whole idea of masked political activism has acquired a bad reputation thanks to the efforts of violent terrorists and of such egregious clandestine groups as the Ku Klux Klan. Thus, though Goblin Hood isn't exactly above harmlessly attending various political rallies and events, it's something he tends to avoid. Nor does Goblin Hood take the attitude that he has a right to wear a mask. I guess he views it as some sort of self-assumed privilege. Apart from whatever constitutional or local law says, Goblin Hood, as a separate entity, has virtually no rights at all. Let's not be silly. He isn't even a citizen of anywhere but Mars. Does that mean it should be open season on Goblin Hood and that he can be shot on sight with virtual impunity? An interesting question, and one which I can only hope nobody ever puts to the test. Don't forget, though, that there's still an American citizen underneath the mask. As to the thorny question of whether or not we Terran citizens should have the right to routinely go around masked, it may surprise my readers to be told that I'm uncertain about that issue myself, which is why the mask isn't intended as a fashion statement, and why I wouldn't willingly encourage others to try emulating this kind of sartorial behavior. I've already stated that masks don't go well with most serious political activity. If nothing else, it just gives the cops what they probably regard as an excuse to start trouble. Nor do I approve of using masks to hide behind during criminal activity, though I certainly recognize the prudence of such a course. I view it as an abuse of the very concept of masks. On the other hand, a ski mask can be reasonably worn in harsh weather. And then there's Halloween and Mardi Gras, which almost seem to have been invented to bring out the Goblin Hood aspect in everybody. In the end, I think it all comes down to personal maturity and responsibility, in which case I'm sad to say that I don't believe most humans are mature or responsible enough to handle wearing a mask without being corrupted by it. We've all heard that power corrupts people, and a certain seductive power is inherent in the ability to look anonymous. H.G. Wells focused, to some extent, on that idea in his novel The Invisible Man. Anyone who has ever been victimized by a violent crime will recognize the disadvantage of not being able to identify the assailant or whatever. Perhaps for this reason, everybody in a violent society like ours seems to get a little nervous about not knowing what someone looks like. Goblinhood, trained in Marcin, trained in harmlessness by Marcin experts, recognizes the kind of fear he inspires and takes pains to appear as non-threatening as possible to strangers. He won't even initiate eye contact as a rule, since some people feel threatened by that. Which doesn't mean that Goblinhood is particularly mature, but he does try to be as responsible about this as he can be and still wear his mask at all. So the question is, how many people, other than criminal predators, if given a chance to avoid the consequences of their actions, would spend their time trying not to even necessarily scare other people? So far, the question hasn't had to be answered, probably in part because most people don't particularly like wearing masks anyway. Jack Vance once wrote a great science fiction story called The Moon Moth, 1961, about a planetary civilization where absolutely everybody wore masks all the time as part of an extremely ritualized culture. There was no way to identify anyone except by the elaborate masks they all wore to indicate their status and prestige, or to express their self-image, or even their particular mood at any given time. You could wear any mask you liked, but you had to be able to live up to it. If you wore a menacing forest goblin mask, for instance, you'd better be able to fight like a forest goblin if you were challenged, which was almost sure to happen. There was no law to intervene, by the way, so might literally did make right. It was, therefore, safest to wear an unpretentious, unassuming, humble moon moth mask, though it was also humiliating, or at least not very flattering to one's ego. In our world, we all wear psychic masks anyway, to disguise our true feelings or whatever. One good argument for wearing real masks would be to prevent our unconscious facial body language from betraying us to individuals looking for some kind of victim. But such predators could look out for other kinds of body language, and in the end, you have to just be what you are. If you're around someone long enough, they'll learn to see through even those psychic masks. So even in this world, it isn't a good idea to look like something you're not, with or without a real mask. As for predatory people, my best advice is to try to stay away from them. If you can spot them behind their everyday psychic masks. If Goblinhood were trying to intimidate people in his mask, he never could have gotten away with it for the past 8 years. On the other hand, the mask does ward off the more casual predators by making GH look crazy enough to maybe be dangerous. Most of us in this culture, at any rate, would probably have trouble emulating the kind of diffidence and self-effacement that Goblinhood paradoxically practices in public as a matter of course. Nor are most people well versed in the fine art of harmlessness, or at least intentional harmlessness, which Goblinhood has made into a lifetime study. Hence, as far as street life is concerned, for few such masked characters are liable to survive long enough, publicly at least, to evolve into artificial life forms. And again, It's not something to mess around with if you don't know what you're doing, so don't try this at home, as they say. Leave it to trained professionals like Goblinhood. The biggest threat posed by masks as a fashion statement probably sounds remote, but is actually all too plausible. It's this, that if everybody wore masks all the time, then the police, who routinely identify us by our faces, would demand some new and probably more sinister method of easy identification, something like a computer chip implanted under the skin, with which they could, no doubt, electronically monitor all kinds of a citizen's activities. I needn't go into the problems this would cause for such institutions as privacy. In any case, we'll be lucky if they don't try this someday on their own hook. But if you wake up one day with Big Brother snooping over your shoulder via computer chip or something, don't blame Goblinhood. He's never advocated the wearing of masks for others. As for himself, his self-assumed status as a sort of low-grade outlaw is a great sacrifice that he's making in order to protect your precious rights to privacy, you bunch of ingrates. Yes, it's a thankless job, but someone has to do it, and that someone might as well be Goblinhood. Do as I say, not as I do, is his quasi-dictatorial policy as a political prisoner of sorts, enthralled to his own sense of higher ethics, which probably makes the poor devil sound like a big hypocrite, I know. And even that's all just part of the great sacrifice. And in that spirit, I'll simply conclude that masks are all right for Goblinhood, who can handle the responsibility and the stigma, and whose antics are unlikely to change much in our society, but that wearing masks is pretty much marked lousy for anyone else, except on Halloween. Good thing they're not something most people would want to wear, huh? Meanwhile, if you do try to steal Goblinhood's thunder with a mask of your own, don't go squalling about your so-called rights when the cops drag you away. Or at least don't squall to me. Back in March 1990, at any rate, Goblinhood was inclined to hope that the authorities would be open-minded, or at least indolent enough to simply go along with the joke. And he decided it was now high time to find out. He was ready to test drive the new mask. There was also the amazing suitcase doll to consider, which was sick of just moping around the house, wishing Buckethead was still alive to take it out on a run. By and by, even the enigmatic Cosmic Weevil doll would begin champing at the bit and demanding a piece of the action as a full-fledged member of what Goblinhood was pleased to think of as Team Goblinhood. But what the dolls, including a later performance-oriented doll called Maya, were willing to settle for calling the Renegade Club. The Renegade Club? Don't ask. Clearly, in any case, the situation was a veritable walking time bomb, looking for a chance to explode. And the gallery hop of March 1990 was chosen as ground zero for a detonation, the reverberations of which are still grudgingly being heard. And so it was, with heart all aflutter, that I set out around 9:30 on that fateful Saturday night, beneath a starry sky that Van Gogh might have been proud of, with the suitcase doll in my duffel bag and the cloth goblin hood mask in my pocket. The plan was that I would just innocuously slide on over to the big gallery hop, find some discreet place to slip into the mask, and then stand revealed, for the first time, as the new and improved version of Goblinhood, who would then mosey on over to the Acme Art Company and spring the new mask on them. He had no idea what they were doing that night, but he hoped, with heart a-tremble, that they too would simply be inclined to go along with the joke. And what if they were more inclined to just snarl and bark things like, "See here, clear out of this goblinhood, you unadulterated knave!" Well, G.H. would have to just cross that bridge when he came to it, no doubt with his tail between his legs and his pathetic little heart going thumpity-thumpity-thump in his pathetic little chest. Right now, however, G.H. was busy crossing his Rubicon. Our watches were all synchronized when we reached High Street, and we couldn't help noticing that the joint was jumping. The gallery hop was in full swing, crowded, no doubt, because of the fairly pleasant, though chilly, early spring-like weather. We were taking it by the numbers. For instance, what would Clark Kent do in a case like this? Why, the first thing he'd do, as in about a zillion DC comic books, would be to find a handy phone booth in which he could take off his glasses and his business suit to stand revealed as Superman, the Man of Steel, or whatever he's called these days. Only problem was that those handy phone booths, in case you haven't noticed, are gone with the wind by now. Fond memories of a lost world. So what to do? Well, there was a payphone hanging on a wall at the opening of an alley, almost right across High Street from the Acme Art Company, whose steamy window from across the street provided scant clues as to the nature of their current activities. That telephone didn't look any too promising, but that alley now seemed a whole nother kettle of fish. So without further reflection, I went sauntering nonchalantly a few yards or so down the alley and turned to face the wall. I pulled the mask dapperly over my head and voila! The magic moment had finally arrived. It was goblinhood time again. In that berserk instant, goblinhood turned around and found himself facing two stalwart officers of the law who had apparently followed him down the alley, probably on a hunch. They looked, I swear, as if they were ready to throw down on the masked muddlehead at the least sign of trouble, which they no doubt were, this goblinhood situation being unexplored territory of sorts and the kind of sticky wicket they probably hadn't bargained on. "Take off the mask," one cop said in a dangerously quiet voice. And so I did, and that right smartly, you can be sure. "You want to show us some identification?" asked one of them, and of course I was glad to at that point, but I had to dig into my duffel bag to get it. At this, their trigger fingers appeared to get even itchier, if that were possible. "Careful with that bag," snapped the jumpier member of that dynamic duo, looking as if he'd like to break my fingers in order to make the bag operation a little safer for him and his partner, if not as efficient. So I dug my state ID card out of the bag in virtual slow motion, idly wondering all the while just what the hell they thought I had in there. And what they'd do if I was to haul out the amazing suitcase doll instead of my card, probably shoot themselves in the foot and take early retirement, I decided. If they didn't shoot the doll, that is. Goblinhood, especially in this mask, may have been a mystery to these cops, but I couldn't help remembering all the times Suitcase had lambasted the authorities in various freak cartoons of not all that long ago. But fortunately, the doll didn't have to come into play during this little showdown. With my card in their custody, they seemed a little more at ease, especially after radioing headquarters or whatever it is that they do in situations like this one. But now began something like a 10 or 15 minute wait for Cops Central or whatever to call back on their little walkie-talkie with the straight poop on my bona fides or whatever it was. While we cooled our heels there, I studied these cops. The jumpier one was very much on the surly side, while the other was more affable than otherwise, just like in the time-honored cliché. I speculated that their names might have been Officers Mutt and Jeff. Meanwhile, it was getting cold standing out there, and people were staring at us as they walked past the alley's mouth. Surprisingly, incredibly, in fact, the friendly cop presently told me that I could put my mask back on, and you can just imagine my alacrity in doing that. I was faster than a speeding bullet. Maybe the cop had thought my face looked cold, but at any rate, I was ready to give him a citizen's citation of excellence in law enforcement or something for being so obliging about that mask, much to the apparent disgust of his partner, who looked as if he hated masks. And so there Goblinhood was again, making his second big appearance so far, snatched from the very jaws of defeat, so to speak. He was getting on top of this situation now, taking these hapless cops under his wing, as it were, smirking around behind his mask, there in the alley as the cops shifted nervously from foot to foot, because now people were really beginning to stare. We'd thrown the script away and things were getting downright improvisational. Still, G.H. couldn't help gazing longingly at the Acme Art Company across the street over yonder, so near and yet so far. "Go along with the joke," he remembered sarcastically. Christ, he wasn't even allowed to cross the street without a note from his mom or something. Earlier, I'd explained to the cops about how I'd been going to surprise the Acme personnel with Goblinhood's mask. Did Acme know I was coming? The cops wondered. Well, that they probably knew that I might show up, but they probably didn't know about the mask. Probably as a hunch, the nicer of the cops had asked, as if suddenly inspired, "Are you part of this gallery art thing?" Well, yeah, sort of, but I didn't have a flyer or anything to prove it. Even now, things were still up in the air until those friendly folks down at the Citadel of Law and Order, or whoever in hell it was, got back to us about my pesky ID card. I was only hoping, from behind Goblinhood's mask, that these two cops wouldn't wind up dragging me into Acme by the scruff of my neck with my face hanging out and saying, "We caught this guy outside wearing a mask." That, of course, wouldn't have been any too swift of an entrance for Goblinhood's big debut. But as things turned out, it would have been the funniest thing that happened all night. Or would it? If that had happened, it might have established a divergent parallel universe where everything went differently. Who can say? And still we waited. The unfriendly cop, who obviously couldn't stand being around Goblinhood, looked as if he was wishing he was in some other universe. The genial cop tried to make conversation with Goblinhood, confiding that it was the bag that had really worried them. And this without them even knowing that suitcase was lurking in that bag. He also explained that they thought GH might have been planning a heist or something. No, muttered Goblinhood, nothing like that. By this time he was beginning to forget what exactly his plans had consisted of. Something about art, wasn't it? But there, anyway, these three stooges pivoted, absurdly and almost endlessly, on the very cusp of Goblinhood's future. But no wonder, since yet one final act in this ridiculous drama was slated to take place. These gallery things are usually pretty quiet, observed the talkative minion of the law, and at that very moment, I swear it, alarums rang boldly out on High Street, fire engines roared to a halt less than a block away, and the fire marshal, or somebody like that, pulled officially into Goblinhood's alley and sat there in his official car, staring bemusedly and dumbfoundedly at the strange tableau of uniformed and masked inhabitants of said alley, undoubtedly wondering just what the fuck was supposed to be going on around here anyway. Interestingly, though, he never quite had the sand to question that mysterious group of worthies, which was probably just as well. In any case, I think the fire was a false alarm or something. Jesus, what next? Thought Goblinhood. A nuclear alert? Both cops, as it happened, were silent after that. Eventually, after the big coffee break or whatever was over downtown, the radio advised these cops to cut Goblinhood loose. And they lost no time in doing just that and in distancing themselves from him with fairly obvious relief. That left Goblinhood to stride triumphantly through the perplexed crowd and to victoriously cross the street to get to the other side, of course. And so Goblinhood's new career began on this rather odd note. The irony here, the punchline of this little fracas, or rather this little fiasco, was that my friend, the painter Smokey Brown, who I'd once worked on some murals with at a place called Metropolitan Hall, turned out to be exhibiting his work at Acme that March. His paintings and strange papier-mâché sculptures not only made a fitting backdrop for something like Goblinhood, but his presence there, had it been necessary, would probably have meant that I could have gotten away with being Goblinhood in any case. But to make matters perfect, to turn the ordinary fiasco into a virtual rout, it also turned out that some kind of performance workshop was going on as well, so that half the people in the gallery were wearing masks anyway, which made old GH look kind of spot on, as it were, or at least dressed for the occasion. And just to twist the knife a little and to rub a little salt in the wound, those two hangdog cops, or two others just like them, came slinking by Acme a while later and peering furtively through the slightly steamed up windows at all those masks and had to go skulking helplessly away into the unforgiving night with the nice cop no doubt musing, "So Goblin Hood was right all along," and the mean cop probably muttering, "We should have shot him anyway." And Goblin Hood could only laugh and laugh and laugh. Meanwhile, where was Libby while the preceding stirring event was going on, and what was she doing? I really have no idea. I know she used to work at a local store called Trade Winds, and I think she may have later been involved with another store called Byzantium, and she may also have had something to do with the King Avenue Coffee House. If so, I can't remember if I ever saw her at those last two. For that matter, as near as I can recall, as of March 1990, I was never to see Libby again, except in my dreams. And while I wished that I had more to offer here than these stupid Goblin Hood cop stories and the like, this remains a fact. I could probably have seen a lot more of Libby than I did, and still not really have known much more about her. As I've already pointed out, getting to know other people well has never exactly been my strong suit. But I'm positive that Libby was alive, and as far as I know, well, on that gallery hop night in March. Though it's sort of spooky for me to reflect that she probably had no idea, as Goblin Hood was playing in his famous alley with those bewildered cops, how little time remained to her. Would Libby have done anything differently had she known that her days were numbered? I can't even guess, since I don't know what she was doing anyway. But whatever she was doing it in the same world as the new and improved version of Goblin Hood. If that makes any kind of difference to anybody but me. And then Libby's time ran out, as it must, eventually, for each of us in this life. And I guess it must have only been 8 or 9 months later when that happened. Again, if I'm wrong about this, I'll make amends in a footnote later on. At this point, sitting here and consulting only my limping memory, I can't even be specific about the date of Libby's tragic demise, but I think it was either November or December of 1990. It must have happened prior to the first Saturday of the month, because I first heard the news at the gallery hop, where it cast a grim pall over the proceedings at Acme. There were other people involved with the gallery who had known Libby, most notably her other erstwhile freep colleague, Paul Volcker. I think Libby was on her way to or from the West Coast. I think it was in connection with some important event, possibly a conference on women's issues or something of the sort. One way or another, the plane didn't make it, and so things didn't go as planned. And if you're wondering why I'm writing about it so offhandedly like this, and even leaving the real details for some handily nebulous footnote, it's because I want you to see, at first hand, just how little of an impression her sudden death made on me at the time. I want you to feel just how cold I can find myself having to be about this kind of stuff, whether I like it or not. The cash register goes ching. A little sign pops up into the window that says, "You're supposed to be sad about this." And so I guess I was sad. But that feeling barely made its way to the surface through my usual gloom. I'm not trying to make myself sound like a monster. I don't think that I am a monster. But I want you to taste the vast wasteland that I'm forced to have to regard as an emotional life. Then, too, there's the fact that some part of me was unable to accept her death as a reality. So it all seemed pretty unreal to the extent that it seemed like anything at all. One thing that did strike me as distinctly odd at the time, and still does, is that I knew somebody else in a whole other sphere of my life, completely unconnected with any of this, who lost a spouse in that same tragic airplane accident. Imagine that. Anyway, Libby, as I've said, never got to know Goblinhood in his present-day incarnation. But Goblinhood certainly knew her, and it seems to me now that her death must have somehow struck him harder than it did struck me. Without Libby, I might not have been doing all those free press cartoons, and hence might never have been so able to insinuate Suitcase and Company, which would eventually mean Goblinhood too, into the community that they're now so much a kind of half-assed part of. And so for Goblinhood, Libby had been, willy-nilly, what I call a facilitator, but what G.H. undoubtedly thinks of as an ally, a comrade in arms, in his relentless struggle to exist as either an art form or any kind of a life force. Life form. Of course, Libby wasn't the only such facilitator, but she was, in her way, a major one, and, too, one of the earliest ones. As for this facilitator business, I can best suggest the impact that it has on Goblinhood by discussing some of the other people who have been even more directly that to him. This essay, of course, hasn't the scope to deal with them all, but I can touch upon the ones that I most need to talk about, starting with a couple of other staunch Goblinhood allies who have also, like Libby, passed out of this realm of physical existence. And I pray, as best I can, that all the others will hang in there among the living for a long time to come. In early 1992, when Goblinhood, who ages differently than the rest of us, was about 10 years old, my late friend, the artist Joel III, was the assistant director of the Acme Art Company. I can't even begin to sketch Joel III in a document this limited. A true portrait of him would probably require volumes. Joel III was another mentor type of person in my life, though I was probably almost twice his chronological age. I looked up to Joel, and I can't help remembering him almost as a kind of benevolent older brother. Well, he was probably at least twice Goblinhood's calendar age, so perhaps that sort of fits. When Joel died a few years back, a victim of the AIDS nightmare, it represented for me a textbook example of my inability to believe in the deaths of people that I know. Of course, I hadn't seen him for a while, as he'd moved to California. So his death was obviously remote in spatial terms. But even apart from that, the idea of him being irrevocably gone struck me as implausible. To me, Joel 3 was larger than life, somehow immortal and, knock wood, invulnerable. Shows how much I know. Eerily, as if to ironically emphasize all this, I received a postcard from Joel 3 right about the same time that I heard of his death. I think he would have enjoyed that. Meanwhile, Joel 3's status as a Goblinhood facilitator or ally is virtually incalculable and leads to one of the funnier cop stories in Goblinhood's meager arsenal of such tales. But first we need a flashback to that earlier encounter with the Fuzz. You might suppose that Goblinhood's successful navigation of those troubled waters would have put him on the street with no problems from that point on. It didn't. Even Goblinhood realized how much good luck he'd been granted on that night. Too much had depended on his having some place specific to go, as opposed to simply wandering menacingly around in his mask. Then too, even at that early stage, G.H. was sensitive about crashing other people's ideas of well-dressed propriety with his outre get-up. For him, this was a matter of principle. His own belief in what he was doing had to be balanced by his belief in the rights of other people to do their things. He wasn't out to force anybody else to put up with his extreme nonconformity, but rather to somehow earn a place for himself in their world. He didn't feel justified in standing on his principles regarding his right to dress as he saw fit, not in a universally maskless world where he was the interloper. All this is difficult to explain. I've tried before in these pages, and it doesn't get any easier as I go along. Perhaps Goblinhood is overly sensitive about this, but I don't think so. Even now, after 8 years of working hard at it, there are still plenty of places where he won't go, because he knows how unwelcome, overtly or otherwise, he would be there. In fact, said places include just about everywhere, even by now. Maybe the key here is to just say, yeah, he's been at it for 8 years and he knows what he's talking about. A Goblinhood run is no easier for him now than it was back then, except that now there are a few places where he's made himself fairly welcome, mostly through long and hard effort of one kind or another, which effort has never included insisting on his right to be doing what he's doing. It's mostly included being as harmless at it and as amiable to people, even his detractors, as he could manage. Back then, though, in early 1990, it was a real dilemma, with his only distinct advantage being the ease with which he could get rid of his mask and stop being Goblinhood whenever it became necessary. And the dilemma was basically this. He certainly couldn't count on some fortuitous masked performance workshop to be happening wherever he decided to go. Whereas just doing it on the street, which is difficult enough even now, would lead to endless hassles with people who didn't understand it or didn't like it. If nothing else, he didn't want to have to keep unmasking himself for some officious flatfoot every time that he tried to go out. Consequently, it was something like a whole year before Goblin Hood was publicly seen again, and then it was only in the context of a stage performance, the aforementioned Citizen Kane extravaganza. As a formal performance art phenomenon, Goblin Hood was well enough received and even had his exploits written about in the Columbus Dispatch, 5/19/91, thanks to my friend Leslie Constable. But Goblin Hood's bag of tricks, his repertoire of poems and cheesy performance stunts, was too limited to afford him a very extensive stage career. What he really wanted was just to hang out at various places, pretty much like anybody else. His performance art chef d'oeuvre, in any case, was simply his own bizarre appearance, especially in any kind of otherwise normal setting. But, as already noted, Goblin Hood realized that that course was fraught with potential perils, pitfalls, and problems, ethical or otherwise. Above all, he didn't want the joke to be over until he was somehow in a position to bargain from strength. And so Goblin Hood desperately grabbed every booking he could muster, even getting himself mixed up with seemingly asinine events at seemingly ludicrous venues. Anything for a little more life, on stage or otherwise. Amongst his best facilitators, or even curators, during this stressful period, were artists Mary Jo Bull, who helped him get a then-coveted gig at a local bar, and Levent Isaac, who curated crucial Goblin Hood performances at Doo-Wack and Roy T. Biv galleries. Goblin Hood also worked with the performance group Lyceum 23 for a while. Obviously, this state of affairs could not long endure without poor Goblin Hood being driven to distraction. The worst of it was the pressure to be entertaining, as opposed to just being weird. This unnatural pressure alone came close to sinking Goblin Hood into the depths of despair. By early November of 1991, following an ironically fallow October, with no performance events happening and with everything else you could wear costumes to costing more money than I had, Goblin Hood was reduced to paying $5 to get into a late Halloween party, an Amnesty International fundraiser, just so that he could wear his mask for a few hours and get away with it. This event was at Stash's Bar, now relocated to the Short North Garden District and renamed Little Brothers. Come as your favorite dictator or your favorite political prisoner, the advertisement for this party had said, and Goblin Hood seemed like a little of both, so here he was, much to everybody else's confusion. Hardly anyone else even wore costumes to this event. I believe my friend Mike Duty showed up wearing one, but neither of us can now remember who or what his costume was supposed to represent. Anyway, I think he gave Goblin Hood a ride home, saving GH a long walk in the cold. And even here, as a paying customer, Goblin Hood was forced to suffer somebody nagging him to remove his mask. "I want to see your face," this person almost whined. "This is my face," replied Goblin Hood more truthfully than he even knew at the time. All this changed because of Joel 3. Early in 1992, Joel 3 inaugurated a weekly Friday night performance venue at Acme called Cafe Ashtray. In a stroke of seemingly sardonic genius, Joel also accepted Goblin Hood as a volunteer to work the door at that fundraising venue on an ongoing basis. At least in part, this displayed shrewd business sense and management. Joel knew of Goblin Hood's little problem and probably realized that GH would be an utterly reliable and tireless co-worker. As it turned out, I think Goblin Hood only missed one Friday night, the first year of Cafe Ashtray's existence. And that was because I, in one of my temporary lapses, hadn't known what day it was. And so consider the contrast here. Instead of having to keep dreaming up increasingly more unlikely performance antics to get himself out there, Goblin Hood was suddenly around every Friday night, thanks to Joel 3. And with nothing more complicated to do than to take patrons' money for the gallery and to hang around looking bizarre. It was a perfect setup for Goblin Hood, whose volunteerism in doing this even made him seem magnanimous and philanthropic. He'd gone, in a trice, from being a disreputable gutter snipe to having an official job of sorts, and was now functioning as a veritable pillar of the community. And it really was a good arrangement, even for picky old Goblin Hood, who normally isn't comfortable hanging around most performance venues. More of his vaunted sensitivity. He reasons that his own theatrical appearance is a distraction from whatever else is supposed to be going on, or else too easily confused with it, where the audience is concerned, hence possibly marring the integrity of someone else's work. But this was just right. Most performances took place downstairs, leaving the considerate Goblin Hood to haunt the gallery proper, shaking down any stragglers for donations to the place, while Joel 3 was free to oversee the main proceedings elsewhere. And so, rather than interfering with what else went on, Goblin Hood's striking image just kind of lent an undertone of sorts to the venue as a whole. Best of all, when Goblin Hood wasn't dealing with customers, he was free to stand on the sidewalk in front of the gallery, almost like a living neon advertisement for the venue, with his suitcase and cosmic weevil dolls, interacting with his true public, whoever happened to pass by and see him there. His favorite audiences consisted of passing buses, each a traveling grandstand full of people who might see Goblin Hood and briefly wonder, what the? And it was while engaged in this harmless occupation during spring of 1992 that Goblin Hood tangled with Deputy Dog. Whilst lounging around in front of the gallery, Goblin Hood couldn't help but notice that a nearby bar, now defunct, was waxing rowdier than usual, even for a Friday night, with belligerent drunks practically cartwheeling out the door, hooting and hollering, threatening to fight anyone they could see through the alcoholic haze, but not Goblin Hood, who they probably thought of as a manifestation of the DTs, and just generally creating a noisy public nuisance there on the Friday night sidewalk. A bad business, that, reflected the reflective gobster. Be lucky if the cops don't have to get called. And sure enough, pretty soon a patrol car cruised by, did some kind of a double take, and stopped, illegally, across the street. Illegally for anyone but a cop, that is. Prudently reflecting that there might be gunplay or something coming up next, Goblin Hood, the very soul of discretion, promptly scarpered back inside with his dolls to assume his appointed position as the cafe ashtray doorman, standing behind a little podium with a cash box on it. Pretty soon he saw the lone cop wandering confusedly up and down the sidewalk with the distinct air of a man who was looking for something that had somehow been misplaced. Presently, the cop chanced to glance in the Acme window, resulting in yet another comical double take. Deputy Dog stepped into the gallery and started literally sputtering. "You, that is, I mean, all that stuff, really. I mean, man, you scared the shit out of me." "Scout's honor," he said that. "I thought you were fixing to rob the bar or something." "No," replied Goblin Hood with perfect equanimity. "I'm just doing my job guarding this money here." And that was that for Deputy Dog, who was reduced to that old hangdog tail between the legs routine. Hell, nobody said law enforcement was supposed to be easy, did they? But maybe the cop's presence in the vicinity had at least quieted the bar proceedings down a little, so that it was, ironically, all for the best. Another public service on the part of civic-spirited old Goblin Hood. And Goblin Hood? An intense David Bowie fan from way back, G.H. was humming what he thought was a line from the Life on Mars track on Bowie's 1971 Hunky Dory album. "Take a look at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, look at those cavemen go." It seemed to Goblin Hood that there must be a moral here somewhere, but unfortunately, not being much of a moralist, he couldn't quite put his finger on it. Oh well, at least he managed to hang on to more of his sang-froid than that poor cop, eh? Another departed Goblin Hood facilitator was my late friend Jim Greenwood. There are no cop stories about Goblin Hood associated with him unless you want to count the crucifixion of Goblin Hood. In that cafe ashtray extravaganza of Good Friday 1993, the fictional cops actually got to crucify Goblin Hood, hopefully as close to such an outrage as any cops will ever get, except maybe in their dreams. I think that performance spectacle may actually have been Jim Greenwood's idea to begin with. In any case, he was heavily instrumental in composing, producing, and performing in that little passion play. He also designed and created most of the show's sets, one of which is commemorated in my comic book, Goblin Hood's Comics and Poems, 1994. But part of Jim Greenwood's genius was to know a good thing when he saw one, and Goblin Hood evidently qualified. Late in 1993, Jim produced, directed, starred in, and designed the sets and costumes for a Cafe Ashtray presentation of Oscar Wilde's classic, The Importance of Being Earnest. As if all that weren't enough, Jim decided to boldly go where no man has gone before by somehow making Goblin Hood a part of the play, both as a kind of masterpiece theater host, mouthing off about Wilde before the play, and also as a weird prompter, sitting off to the side and occasionally feeding lines to the actors on stage, who seemed to have only a desultory awareness of him. Strangest of all, this odd conceit seemed actually to work well enough that I think Wilde himself would have probably dug this production. Like Joel III, Jim Greenwood died tragically young. Had he lived longer, he might have found ways and means to help Goblin Hood crash even greater heights of culture. But lest you get the idea, knock wood, that there's a curse or something on people who help Goblin Hood out in significant ways, the rest of Goblin Hood's most important allies are still, presumably, happily walking among us, as of this writing, insofar as I know. And like I said, I hope they'll stay that way as long as possible. I'm getting really sick of outliving people that I care about. Certainly, one of the most spectacular of those allies is my friend Laurie McCarkish, who became the Acme Art Company director during the summer of 1990. Shortly after that, I became a full-fledged gallery volunteer, gallery sitting, helping to hang shows, helping with openings, with mailings, the whole nine yards. This would continue for some 5 years and would represent the longest stretch of time that I've ever been able to stick with anything other than my own work. I think of it as my community service period, and attribute a lot of my ability to do it to my pleasure in working with Lori, with whom I enjoyed the longest consistent working relationship that I've ever had with anyone. Of course, my involvement with Acme didn't remain entirely consistent. I suffered frequent periods of burnout, the first of which came a little over a year after I'd started. Lori brought me back on that occasion, as she would manage to do repeatedly, just in time for Joel III to elevate Goblin Hood to the doormanship of Cafe Ashtray. So I guess you could say that my involvement with the gallery was steadily evolving right through there, or maybe just mitigating or mutating. Lori helped those changes along. In many ways, she's a truly remarkable person. But if she remains special to me for reasons such as these, then think what she must mean to Goblin Hood, who for some months actually got to be a gallery sitter, mask and all, during the gallery's normal daily hours, thanks to Lori. I haven't space here to discuss Lori's many accomplishments as an arts administrator, nor her achievements as a top-notch photographer. I have to limit my comments to Lori's adventures with Goblin Hood, and only the most important ones of those. For instance, Lori got a chance to do some promo for Acme in a short-lived publication called Columbus Art and Gallery Magazine. Consequently, the back cover of that mag's fall 1992 issue featured a full-page photo of Acme's exterior, with Goblin Hood and his suitcase and Cosmic Weevil dolls standing in front of the place, smirking triumphantly, in full living color. Their only color photograph to be published anywhere to date, I do believe. Arguably, their nocturnal presence in front of the gallery made Lurie's back cover magazine photo an ad for Cafe Ashtray, too. With subtle irony, stacks of that magazine were distributed at Ameriflora, the big international flower show that Columbus was hosting that year. Rumor has it that the evocative image of Goblin Hood was instrumental in transforming at least one local artist working at Ameriflora into a stalwart Acme volunteer. Not bad for a grubwort like Goblin Hood, wouldn't you say? The irony here is that Goblin Hood himself never set foot inside Ameriflora. How could he? What with that pesky mask and all? As for me, I seldom go anywhere that I know Goblin Hood can't go. Not that a recluse like me wants to go anywhere in any case. However, on the creepier side of Ameriflora, specifically outside, near the front gate on opening day, Goblin Hood was fully involved in the festivities through one of his most ambitious capers to date. This was the fabled exorcism of then-President George Bush, who attended Ameriflora that day, but who snubbed the invitation Goblin Hood had sent him at the White House to attend the exorcism as well. There's barely time as this prologue drags on and on for even a cursory examination of said startling event. I can't even go into the impressive Goblin Hood and Merry Man campaign, in which Goblin Hood, with a female running mate, was supposed to be running for president. But then you all know how that turned out anyway, right? But I should mention that this scenario marked the second or third run-in that Goblin Hood had with the police, depending on when exactly that so-called deputy dog affair took place. Goblin Hood had more or less organized this opening day event, and he stood pretty central to it as the self-appointed exorcist. When the police showed up, mostly I think to see that it didn't get out of hand, Goblin Hood was pretty much one of the people they seemed interested in. But at least he got to keep his mask on this time while talking to them. Of the three cops involved, probably chosen for their ability to deal with lunatics or something, the most affable of the bunch passed a little chit-chat with the affable gobster. The cop was asking questions about the exorcism itself. George Bush, who hadn't had the guts to hang around, was long gone by the time we even got there, 6 p.m. for people who, unlike Bush, had had to work that day. So I can see why the whole thing might have seemed pointless to the untrained eye. Still, it worked anyway, didn't it? That's the mark of a good exorcism, when it works anyway, under no matter what slipshod circumstances, even at long distance, and even if we wind up with someone like Clinton for president instead. I mean, you could have elected Goblin Hood and Merryman, after all, but no. In any case, Bush brought all this on himself by making that famous speech early in his administration against broccoli, my favorite vegetable, and refusing to serve it, or at least to eat it, at the prestigious White House. You can't insult a terrific legume like that with impunity. And then there was the very suspicious time that Bush threw up, just like Linda Blair in that movie, on those Japanese honchos or whatever it was, during a trade mission or something, probably from not having enough broccoli in his diet. But what really had us worried, some of us, was the way that evangelist and failed right-wing politician Pat Robertson kept whining and yapping around about Bush's so-called New World Order on television and acting as if Bush was the Antichrist or something. Yes, I'm sure that had a lot of people worried. That and the ugly rumors started by me about a sinister Satanist for Bush conspiracy. I can't imagine how Bush ever expected to get away with that little number. All this and more was what made the Bush exorcism so damned imperative. I mean, in matters of global security, better safe than sorry, an old Martian proverb, has always been Goblinhood's firm policy. None of the foregoing, however, could have profitably been explained to that cop who was just doing his job. Still, I remember the kindly policeman asking G.H. something like, "Have you ever done one of these exorcism things before?" "Yes," replied Goblinhood guardedly, meaning that I had, way back when Nixon was president. But that's another story. Anyway, nothing happened. The cops, who obviously didn't have the clout to deal with Goblinhood, and maybe get Ameriflora mixed up in a nasty interplanetary incident, simply hung around until we all split. And their cop vibes may even have helped the magic work, for all I know. Speaking of making the magic work, I should point out that while all this was going on, including some 30 or 4 dedicated people waving broccoli stalks and chanting things like, "Put broccoli back in the White House," and "Mary Mann's a woman," an accordion version of some famous exorcism music was being played by the Evolution Control Committee, courtesy of musician / performer Mark Gunderson, another founding member, Cafe Ashtray.